This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. We live with our bodies. They become part of how we identify ourselves. We love our bodies, hate our bodies, struggle with them, struggle against them. On today's Yin Radio show, we talk about our bodies, ourselves. I have four installments for you on this theme. First, we explore body image and the pressure to be thin. Then we join a group of actors who know how to use their bodies to express emotion. Last of all, we get naked in two installments from the great outdoors. One comes from a group soaking in the natural hot springs in north central Idaho, and one's an essay celebrated naked dancing in the moonlight. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Our theme today is Our Bodies, Ourselves. Installment number one comes from Molly Stoddard, who interned with Yin Radio in the fall of 2007. She prepared this piece about body image, which aired previously in October 2007. Armed with some basic understanding of eating disorders and the pressure to be thin, Molly spoke with her friend Alyssa about her self-image related to weight. Alyssa's body image has been an issue for her since she was young. Her story reflects an issue that is central to a large portion of American women of all generations.
Children have become extremely vulnerable to America's obsession with being thin. Research shows 42% of first to third grade girls want to be thinner. 81% of 10-year-old girls are afraid of being fat. 91% of women in college have attempted to control their weight. And that number is of no surprise to me, because on the University of Idaho campus, 80% of the women I see appear to have an eating disorder. What stemmed this obsession with image? Are eating disorders a learned behavior? Does the media encourage this need to be thin? After all, fashion models are 98% thinner than the average American woman. The average American woman is 5'4 and weighs 140 pounds. The average American model is 5'11 and weighs 117 pounds. I would like to invite my friend Alyssa to the show to share some of her opinions and struggles with image as a young woman in American society. How important is image to you?
Well, I think it's really important, especially to women at my age, I think in their early 20s. It's always been kind of a competitive thing, I think, especially among friends. I was always competitive with how I looked among my friends, especially in high school. I was an athlete, so that didn't help. Everybody always seemed to be competitive for who could have the better body or the leaner body, and the leaner you were, the faster you would swim, and things like that. But I always thought the image thing would go away. And then you get into college and you realize it's even more of a prevalent problem.
Do you think women have become obsessed with being thin?
Definitely. That's why I think half the world's on a diet. I mean, yes, it's probably the biggest obsession. I think I've been obsessed with image since I was 12. I think our society has associated thinness with beauty. Rather than in the olden days when normal or even obese women, not even obese, but just, you know, what we would consider immensely overweight today were beautiful. And it signified wealth that they were normal sized. And today it's like if you see a woman at a normal size of 5'4", 145 pounds, you're going to look at her and say, wow, she's a little chubby. She's a little overweight. Versus you see a woman walking down the street that's 5'4", 110 pounds, you think, wow, that girl's really hot. That girl's beautiful. I wish I looked like her. And so women start getting this in their head, comparing subconsciously, comparing consciously, comparing to, talking about it with other friends, and then it becomes an epidemic because, you know, you'll meet a friend that says, well, let's lose this amount of weight together, or let's not eat for a week and see how much weight we can lose. And that's why it's become an epidemic, because everybody encourages thinness in everybody else. And so the thinner you are, the better you are. And I think that that's what's taken over our society, especially for women.
Now, you said since you were 12, it's been an issue for you. Is that because of an athlete, or is this environmental, or more environmental than just being an athlete?
Yeah, definitely. The reason I relate it back to 12 years of age is just because I think around that time, my swimming was starting to decline a little bit. I'd always been a great swimmer since I was little, and once my body started to mature, I started to gain weight and fill out, and the more weight I had, the more I had to drag through the water. And so I remember my mom telling me one day, you know, if you could lose 10 to 20 pounds, you'd be a lot better swimmer. And that went straight to my head, of course, because swimming was very important to me, and I did want to be the top, and I always did. And so ever since then, I just thought I was too fat. I was overweight because I was a slow swimmer and swimming was my life. And because my mom told me I was overweight, it must be true. And so, ever since 12, you know, this constant checking myself out in the mirror, checking myself out in the window panes, checking myself out as I walk along store windows. I mean, anything where I can get a glimpse of my body or what I look like or how my clothes look on me, I take that opportunity. And that's why I say it's an obsession, because since when can a woman not walk across a window without peering at herself in the reflection? I mean, it's disgusting. And I'm guilty of it just as much as any other woman.
Have you felt pressure from society to have an eating disorder?
Oh, definitely. Because, I mean, if you're not thin, you're not attractive. If you're not attractive, you're not going to attract the attention you want from certain people. And therefore, what good are you going to be? And it's hard socially, too. I mean, part of the epidemic, you know, if all your friends are underweight and you're not, then how does that make you look? That makes you look like the standout, but you're really normal size. But, you know, to the rest of society who's caught up in the epidemic, you look overweight, and then there's this peer pressure. Well, you know, you look like you've gained a little weight. Maybe you should cut back on this or cut back on that, or maybe you should exercise more. And,
Have you ever had an eating disorder?
I wouldn't go as far as to say I've had a severe eating disorder. I think, for a couple of years around my junior and senior year of high school, I started to get pretty obsessed with it. Only because I'd always had a great athletic body. And my junior year, I started to fill out a little bit. And I wasn't sure if it was because I was eating more or if I was, you know, not working out as hard as I used to or if my metabolism just slowed. But for some reason, I gained about, you know, 10 to 15 pounds my junior year from what I had been for, you know, quite a few years. And that really bothered me. I started, I remember this one day at track practice. I was pole vaulting, and there was about 8 or 9 other pole vaulters along with me, and everybody had to stand in line one day on the track, and we all had to step up on a scale and get weighed, just because pole vaulters generally need to be on the lighter side to be able to fling their bodies over the bar. And I never thought of myself as heavy or overweight. I always thought of myself as very muscular and very lean, and it wasn't until I stepped up on the scale and actually weighed more than any other of the 9 girls that I panicked. And I think I stopped eating. I think I ate. I wasn't completely anorexic, but I was hardly eating. And I lost about, you know, I'd say I'd lost 10 or 20 pounds. So my senior year of high school, I was pretty small. You know, I'm 5'4", and I weighed about 110 pounds.
How much did you weigh the day you weighed in?
132.
And how much did the other girls weigh?
They were, you know, they were, I think there was one girl that was 130, and that was enough for me to be the heaviest girl out there, thinking I was the prime athlete. You know, it really sent me over the edge. And I think the girls averaged in between 115 and 125, most of them. And so I just felt immensely overweight. And
that isn't a normal weight for athletes. Athletes are usually heavier than that, right?
Right. And yeah, and plus swimmers, especially swimmers have a ton of muscle. I mean, and I should have known that most of that was muscle at that time. But, you know, I had gained a significant amount of weight. And it was very depressing to me. And then especially to have it reconfirmed when I stepped up on the scale in front of my classmates was probably one of the most embarrassing things I've ever gone through. And it shouldn't have been, but it was an image problem and everybody has it. And I had it at that age and I'd had it since I was 12, you know, and I was what, 17 or 18, and it was still obviously there. And then that just reconfirmed in my mind that I was definitely overweight, especially since I weighed more than the girls my age.
When in fact you weren't at 132. That's a pretty healthy weight for
someone. Right, 132, I mean, in all honesty, I weigh 142 at the moment, and I feel significantly overweight still. And if I, and you know, I look back and I think, geez, wow, if I was 132 right now, I'd be thrilled. And that was only, well, that was about 4 or 5 years ago, so it's been a while. But I still feel, even if you ask me now, do you think 132 is a good weight for you? No. I think it's about 10 pounds more than I should be.
How often do you think about your weight?
like per day or?
During the day, how many times are you obsessing about your weight?
Constantly. I can't, you know, when I'm getting ready to get in the shower, I'm looking in the mirror, and there's always extra something here or there. When I put on my clothes, my stomach sticks out too far. My legs are too big for my pants, or, you know, my boobs are too big, or my arms are too flabby, or things like that. So I'm constantly thinking about it. I'm constantly self-conscious of how my clothes look on me.
But in reality, the average American woman is 5'4 and weighs 140 pounds, which is just about right where you are.
Right, but the women that are 5'4 at 140 pounds are considered overweight. Therefore, if you buy into the epidemic, it's not surprising that I believe that I need to weigh less.
Do you feel this is a learned behavior?
Yes, definitely. I don't think women are born thinking that they're not beautiful. I think they're told they're not beautiful. I think they either have a parent that's influential in this area. They have coaches. If they're an athlete, they have coaches telling them that they need to slim down. They have either peer pressure. Maybe they have a boyfriend that says, I'll only date you if you're a certain amount of weight. Or a partner or anyone. I think if anybody tells you, I think the second that somebody tells you you could be thinner, it goes straight to your head. And I think people are very fragile that way.
So do you think parents can influence this?
Yes, definitely. Me being the daughter of a bulimic mom, I think it's dangerously influential. I think, you know, if my mother didn't have an eating disorder and didn't have a problem with her image, I don't think she ever would have commented to me that I looked too fat or that I needed to lose weight. I think she would have thought I was beautiful the way I was, but because she doesn't believe she's beautiful, she passes that on to me, you know, her only daughter. And because she's never been thin enough, I can never be thin enough.
How long has she had bulimia?
I think she's been bulimic pretty much since she was a teenager, and she's now 57.
What is her weight and height?
She is 5'8", 110 pounds.
Do you also think the media perpetuates eating disorders?
Yeah, definitely. You mean like magazines and catalogs,
yeah, like
and modeling and
Hollywood.
Oh, that's the worst. Yeah, because in our society, what's more entertaining to kids that are in the prime time image phase? Hollywood, movies, magazines, stores.
Rock stars,
yeah, anything that people idolize, that children idolize. I mean, I consider 10 and 12-year-olds children And you're telling me that these kids have image problems? I mean, that's not surprising. At 12, I think I started to develop it. But as early as 10, I mean, that's really sick and it's really worrisome. And yeah, definitely. I think the media is probably, I think besides family, if it's coming directly from family, you're in big trouble. But if you don't get it from your family, you're going to get it from the media. So I think women and men, I mean, men have eating disorders, they're just not as prevalent as women. But
yeah, they're about 10% of what women, the number of women that have eating disorders.
Right. And I think, yeah, I mean, how many kids that are exposed to image problems watch, you know, the Oscars? I mean, you see these 6-foot women walking down the red carpet and they're about a quarter of the size of you, and you think, wow, look how glamorous she is. I want to look like her. Mm-hmm. So then these women start, these girls start thinking, well, I better start now, because if I don't start now, I'm not going to look like that when I'm that age.
Right.
And I mean, I had a friend who went on a diet because she wanted to look like Paris Hilton by the time Halloween came around, because she wanted to be Paris Hilton for Halloween. She thought she needed to lose 10 to 20 pounds just to look like her. I mean, how extreme are we going to go? A woman's going to lose weight just to become a character at Halloween?
How much did she weigh? Wasn't she already pretty thin?
Already pretty thin. She's already, she was an athlete, tall, muscular, not overly muscular, just pretty normal. And
was she like 125?
Oh, I would guess, yeah. I mean, she's probably 5'8". She probably weighed 125, 130. And for 5'8", that's underweight. And she thought she needed to lose a certain amount of more weight in order to look like a celebrity. Mm-hmm. And that's partly that person's fault for letting somebody get into their head that much.
Right.
But I mean, but that's what happens. That's the only reason women have eating disorders, is because people get in their heads. Celebrities, mothers, fathers, coaches, mm-hmm. teachers. You know, I mean, anybody can get in anybody's head and persuade them to be any size that they think that they should be. And the person believes it with all their heart, and then they go for it, and then we lead to extremism.
Right. And so essentially you had it from three angles. You had the pressure from the swimming to be thin and drop weight. You had pressure from your mother who's had bulimia for 30 years. And you have pressure from society. Mm-hmm. So that's three different angles, and I'm sure you're not the only woman that gets it from three different angles anymore. Our peers seem to perpetuate the problem.
Mm-hmm. But I must say that even though I am a victim of these three different, you know, angles coming at me in all different directions, here I am today at 23 years of age, and I'm a normal height and weight. And I think that should be hope for women out there who think that controlling their weight is the only way to go, and that there are healthy ways to lose weight if you need to lose weight, and that you don't need to starve yourself, and you don't need to throw up your food, and that even if you do need to lose a few pounds, you're still beautiful the way you are. And women need to start believing that. It needs to be promoted more often that women women don't need to be skeletons to be attractive.
Thank you, Alyssa.
You're welcome.
That was Alyssa talking about pressure from three angles. She was interviewed by Molly Stoddard. Here's Allison Crow with Alive and Breathing.
Thank you.
That's Allison Crowe. Check her out at allisoncrowe.com. That's AllisonCrowe.com. This is Yin Radio. Today's topic, our bodies, ourselves. Body language. It's a tool of the trade for actors. At Washington State University, actors use body language in a unique training program for veterinary students. The actors portray real people who have pets, service animals, and farm animals that they bring to the teaching hospital for care. And when you take your pet to the vet, there's much more to the diagnosis than just the illness of the pet. The family situation, the emotional connection to the pet, and even the owner's philosophies about things like euthanasia come into play. The actors create simulated client cases that help students to learn to deal with these issues beyond and above the medical diagnosis of the animal. The cases that are used to teach students to work effectively with clients are full of emotion and have multiple layers. At WSU's vet school, students learn how to deal with all these emotions through these simulated client cases, which are real cases portrayed by actors. Andriette Piron is one of those actors. For Yin Radio, she talked to her fellow actors about how they use their bodies to bring their characters to life. Emily is the youngest of the acting troupe, a high school student. Andriette speaks with her first.
And what's the character that you play?
Diane Trimble, and I'm a shy 16-year-old. And I absolutely feel my body language change, because I am a shy person, but I also feel as though I'm fairly confident. But when I go in there, I sit down and my shoulders roll forward, and I don't really look at them, and I giggle a lot, like nervous giggling. And I don't talk too much, and I just, yeah, I do this, nervous habits. It's weird, you definitely get into the character and you become so introverted, and then they're like, okay, it's over, and I'll stand up and go in there and be like, oh, okay, and I won't be hunched over anymore.
So the body language or the body movement, it makes a huge difference for your part, makes you really get into your part more, feel your part.
Yeah, I feel like it really
you
does.
Wouldn't do that, feel that way without just the words.
Yeah, because if I was sitting all upright and making direct eye contact, I don't think I could come across as incredibly painfully shy. It would sort of contrast what I was trying to get across.
Even at 16, Emily is well aware of how her body evokes emotion. Real emotion. Actors Janice, Sally, and Frankie share some additional specific body language insights.
Specifically, how do you use your body to portray your character?
When I'm impatient, I'm tapping. And I'm tapping my foot, and I'm especially not when the student is actually talking to me, but in between times, because I'm worried, so I'm tapping. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I use, especially with the students that don't want to look at me, I use a very intense facial expression, using, you know, to try to get them to see me, mm-hmm. to look at me. Mm-hmm. And I also, I'm a kind of a skinny, wiry person anyway, and I use a lot of, I use hand gestures a lot. My hands are kind of flighty and nervous, mm-hmm. because I'm the same character she is, and so I'm worried, I'm impatient, and so I convey that with body tension and hand movement.
I notice a real difference in the two cases that I do. Because the one case, I am in a position of authority. I'm a manager of a very large organization, a very large dairy. And so I sit up very straight and act very confident you know, I'm looking directly at them with eye contact and expecting them to look back at me and have a very open facial expression. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other case, I have ASIC course probably because of a shot I have given, and so I'm not confident. So I am bending over a little more, folding into myself as a way of demonstrating that my concern and my lack of confidence in what I've done. My face is, I'm not looking with eye contact so much and knitting my brow more, and, you know, how you demonstrate worry mm-hmm. in your facial expression and your whole body language. And with me, it's not so much the fidgeting with the worry. Sometimes people will do that when they're worried. It's right. Folding in
on yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, when you were developing this character, did that come naturally, or did you think, now, what kinds of actions could I put in? Did you think consciously about
it? I thought consciously about it, and it was even a point of discussion in learning the case, both cases, mm-hmm. as we practiced through it. What are some of the things that we can do to portray? And we all had some different ideas, and sometimes different things work for different people. As Sally said, it depends on maybe your own body build and your own personality.
Another thing I can think of, playing off of what you were discussing about the insecurity and the withdrawal, one of the cases that I did was the Sasha case about declawing cat. And it was interesting because when I did the case, I had very long fingernails. Mm. And so I was able to transfer what the cat would feel mm-hmm. to having the ends of my fingers cut off. Mm-hmm. And it scared the bejabbers out of the students. It was like, and I put up one of my really long fingernails in front of them. I said, it's like cutting off the end of your fingers. And it was, like that. But it was almost graphic.
Right, so
you could use your body.
For a visual image.
For a visual.
Wow.
It was very effective.
Yeah. I played that case, too.
You did.
But I didn't have long fingernails, and maybe I'll have to grow them the next time I play the case.
No, you used your body in a different way.
Or get those fake ones and put them on or whatever.
No. But have any of you done the cases where you have to cry?
Oh, yes.
I haven't yet.
That requires, your whole body has to get into that to make it believable.
Yeah,
I haven't
those
had
are
to
hard
do that
by the
yet,
end of the day.
I haven't had to do it yet.
Yeah. That's my case right now.
Once with Sasha, I came to tears out of frustration and fear that there was nothing that could be done, and that somehow my relationship with my pet would have to be sacrificed in order to save my relationship with my husband and my family.
Right.
And that almost brought me to tears, but it was tears of frustration rather than tears of grief.
Expressing emotion is the point of this attention to body language, yet the body language can turn around and create real emotion for the actor. Luis tells us how it works for him.
My role in this particular scene has been to be pissed off. Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty easy to do when you're 6'1" and 250 pounds, and I have a voice, and I'm a man, and I can just have an attitude and just pretend to not care. I don't care about this person. I take up the whole space. My voice fills the whole room, and I'm unapologetic. And I'll just beam them into the wall if they don't do anything. You know, they're just confused, and I rattle them, and that, in terms of the character, gives me some degree of pleasure because I have power. And that power just goes right through them, and they have to deal with that. So that's one way, just using my size.
Right. Do they feel pretty scared, do you think?
Oh, it's been really surprising to see, I know I'm playing a role, but in that moment, I'm actually getting upset. And I'm not pretending anymore. I actually go home upset, and I have to talk to my partner to calm down because I'm mad.
Right.
And I'm mad that I'm here. I'm mad that they made me wait 30 minutes. I mean, this is all the scenario that they've given me. I've been sitting there for 30 minutes, and they come in, and then they apologize. And I tell them, what good is your apology? You know, apology doesn't solve anything. I said, I would say, be more understanding. I said, I understand that you're upset. Let's sit down and get this taken care of so we can get you out of here. But instead, they say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And they're just constantly apologizing. I feel like, you know.
Makes you even madder.
Makes me even madder. That doesn't help me at all.
Right.
That's not being understanding at all. And so I get to play the, you know, the heavy guy and with a big voice and just say, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with this operation? You know, what kind of business do you run here?
Right.
And so there's a lot of fun to that. But the side effect, though, is that as an actor, I go away from this session and I have to, it takes me about half an hour to calm down because
right.
I'm actually a pretty mellow guy.
Have you ever had a situation where somebody was able to calm you down and sort of disarm you and understand?
The best one today was when they said, Mr. Dunlop, and by the way, that's not my name,
yeah.
Mr. Dunlop, would you like a glass of chocolate?
A glass of chocolate?
A glass of chocolate. And I just totally just broke and started smiling. I mean, that was the most effective way to just make me just, you know, be mellow. And I said, sure, of course I'd like a glass of chocolate.
Great. So using food or drink is a good way.
Food or drink is always a good way to.
If you have an angry person in
yeah.
front of you.
How about a little glass of chocolate for you?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So that was good.
Cool.
Yeah, and there was one other girl that, I shouldn't say girl, young woman who, there was another young woman who just immediately cued into the fact that here's this guy who's pissed off and said, I understand, Mr. Dunlop, we're going to just do these three things and get you out of here. And I said, great, that's all I want.
Good.
So she clued into what I needed and got me out of there. I think we were in and out in 30 seconds. That's how fast it was.
Wow.
Luis is aware of how his body language affected the students. And that's the point of the program, says program creator Suzanne Kurtz and Brian Gromoff. Suzanne started the simulated client program in Calgary, Canada, for teaching in human medicine before she adapted it for the vet school at WSU, the first school in the U.S. to adapt this program for veterinarian students. Andriette explored the importance of body language for training vet students with Suzanne Kurtz and Brian Gromoff.
How important, you know, do you think it is that they use body language for you, Suzanne, on the other end of the learning process for the students? You know, what difference does that make?
This facility is here partly because we think nonverbal behavior is so important.
Mm-hmm.
This allows us to videotape students interacting with simulated clients, or in some cases with volunteer clients who are portraying themselves, and to watch that interview on videotape later. So
can
that
you
they
speak
can
just a little louder?
Yeah, so that they can see what they're really doing as opposed to what they think they're doing. Our communication self-perception, whether it's the verbal part of what we're doing or the nonverbal part of what we're doing, isn't high. We think we know what we're doing. Often we do, often we don't. And we perceive ourselves, we tend to perceive ourselves to be doing what we intend to do as opposed to what we are in fact doing. So nonverbal behavior carries so much of the social meaning of what we do that it's critically important for professionals to learn how they come across nonverbally and to work on making it more intentional and appropriate. And it's learned skill. So for all those reasons, that's part of why this facility is here. Certainly professionally, if you don't get your nonverbal behavior connected to your verbal behavior, you're going to be at a loss. There will be problems. If you get it connected, you are much more likely to have satisfied clients, satisfied patients, if it's a physician whom I also work with, satisfied yourself, because the relationships become much more satisfied. So much is connected with the way we come across through nonverbal means.
Mm-hmm.
In social message, they're saying, I don't know, 97%. I don't know how they figure these things out exactly, but it's very high.
proponent or component of what we do in terms of passing meaning mm-hmm. back and forth.
From the actor's point of view, in these simulated cases, of course, it depends upon the way the interviewer is asking the questions or responding to them. That will change the body language of the actor at that point.
Exactly.
And what we're hoping, of course, is that the interviewer will see that and will understand why the actor did that. In an acting, in a theatrical way, of course, the actor is embodying the character, and as they think about that character in connection with the director, as the director sees that character, so the body will build up. For myself, I find the character, believe it or not, when I put the character's shoes on. Mm-hmm. When you've got the shoes on, then the character is there and has evolved fully. And this is why I tend not, even though a lot of directors want rehearsal shoes, want you to wear rehearsal shoes, I never put mine on till I think the character is all there. And then I put them on, and then the whole character is there. And you know, with some, depending on the play, of course, you know, if you're playing Richard III, you're going to have a hump or some sort of body change.
Right.
So that sometimes the playwright has given you that,
right.
And so you're building that into it. Otherwise, you just have to find out what another character says about you, what you yourself say about yourself, in order to find that character and therefore that body language that that character will use.
Right. Do you find that to be kind of a flowing process, that you keep adding body characteristics to a character, but you say you put the shoes on and the character is there?
No, I don't put the shoes on until I think I've got the character.
Until you think that,
yeah.
Okay.
So I don't use that to make the character.
Right.
That's the final piece.
But each action or body language piece that you put into your character, are those chosen specifically for that character, or do they...
Usually chosen for that character, but again, what you do in the rehearsal process is you try different things.
Mm-hmm.
And if you and the director will agree that that's a good one, then you'll keep that.
Right.
If you try one and it doesn't work and the director doesn't like it, and it doesn't seem to work from his image point of view of the play, then you get rid of it and you add another until... So it's layer upon layer until you're finally there.
Right. And how do you feel that these quote-unquote amateur actors are doing in terms of their ability to use their bodies to portray their characters?
I think they're fine. With a lot of them, of course, it's just them being that particular man or woman in that particular case. But I don't try and add on body images to them. I'm hoping that throughout, by playing the character and understanding the character and the case, then that will evolve on them. Because if you just try and put something on them, then they're, in quotes, acting it.
Right.
And I don't want them to act it. I want it to come out of what happens.
Right.
Because each scenario is different.
Yeah.
Each interviewer may be different, so that will change the way they behave with that interviewer. So you don't want to make it so solid that they can't change.
Right.
Now, you may want to do that if it's an evaluation, but you don't necessarily want to do that in a learning situation from the interviewer's point of view.
Right.
Yeah, I would add, too, that this is about body image, but nonverbal behavior, in a communication sense, has lots to do with the way the voice is used.
Right.
Or with the way the facial expression looks, which isn't exactly body motion.
Mm-hmm.
It is, of course, but eye contact, what you do responsively with your face or don't do, and with your voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that element of it is critical, too, in addition to what you do with what we normally call body movement.
That comes from Andriette Perron, an actor with Washington State University's Vet School Simulated Client Program. She spoke with her fellow actors and the program creators on December 3rd, 2009. Installment number 3 on this Yin Radio Show. in the great outdoors of Idaho, surrounded by a rippling river, a covering of snow and stately trees, Andriette Piran and I took a dip in a natural hot spring. The water flows out scalding hot down a rock face up the steep banks of the river. It's caught in a pool that sits some 20 feet up the riverbank. On a cold winter day, it is warm and toasty in the water. The best way to enjoy this natural setting is, of course, au naturel. And most visitors do that. They simply strip off that warm winter gear and plunge in. This recent Sunday after Thanksgiving, Andriette and I arrived to find that pool full of clothed dippers, much to my surprise. But we were among the first to change that tendency, and after a while, some dippers leaving and new ones arriving, the pool was mixed in their clothing choices. We were bold enough to plunge in nude, so of course we were bold enough to pull out a recorder and talk to our fellow hot spring dippers about nudity.
Came up with the right question.
How comfortable are you, as we sit around here, half of us naked, with nudity? Your own body and that of others.
Start with
you
Sandy.
Go first, Andrea.
I'm pretty comfortable with it, as you can see. I know this is the radio, but if you could see me now, you would know what I mean.
It would not be. We could not. If it were not radio, we wouldn't be able to air it.
Well,
in prime time.
Darling, nobody cares about me, but on the air, I would be better naked if I'm on radio than on TV, if you know what I mean.
Not true.
All right, that's my answer.
I'm actually pretty comfortable, but I don't like, I still think from other people's perspective, so I don't want to make other people uncomfortable. And when I arrived here and there were so many people in the pool, I was just like, oh, I'm not going to mess with, you know.
So you arrived and everybody was clothed?
Yeah, they were all clothed, so I just hopped in clothed. And went with that. And now it's funny, we're like making the transition.
Not me, yeah. I was here a couple weeks ago, and there was a pool full of mostly guys, and they looked like they were maybe a little bit redneckish, and everyone was wearing clothes, and I was like, hey guys, watch this, I'll clear the pool out. So I went and got in, stood there for a little bit, let them, you know, soak me in, and sure enough, after being in the pool for a good 10-15 minutes, a bunch of them got up and left. So.
Do you think that was directly due to your nudity?
I was the naked guy, the only one, so. And if for your listeners at home, I'm pretty hideous looking, so. About 450 pounds.
Is he milking it or what?
My face for radio.
What does he want to hear next? No, he's the best looking one in here.
Okay.
So just we're on radio.
Well, on the hike up here, we were told there was a couple of cougars up here.
It took me forever to figure out what you
meant. I know, I was like, yeah, there was some dead kill on the way in.
Yeah.
That's us.
A little tuft of rabbit fur on the log.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Well, I feel pretty comfortable with my nude body and everything, but sometimes I feel like I don't want everybody to see it. You know, you have to be privileged.
Sounds like you're
not. There's a challenge going on. We're not very privileged, obviously. The radio community doesn't know she's in her bikini.
I've actually always been very comfortable in my nude state, and especially in these hot springs up here. But tonight, when there were so many people in the pool, like Patty said, I was like, oh, I'll just go in my boxers. But then when I dropped my drawers, I was wearing my long johns, and they weren't on, so I was like, oh, I'm going in naked. And I've never regretted the decision at all.
Dan likes to go to the hot springs naked. Don't let him fool you.
I'm definitely.
Then a couple of cougars followed you in, so.
Dan was the lead for me because I was the second naked person in, and the only reason I was naked was because Dan was naked. I even gave the pool an option. I stood there in my underwear.
I did. I said, you guys,
I could come in. Would you like
to see the rest? This is my underwear. Or if that would offend you, you know, or, I mean, if I would offend you. And they're like, no, take it all off. So I'm like, okay. So I did.
That's awesome.
Isn't that what happened?
Kind of like that.
I didn't used to be very comfortable with my nudity because I was raised Mormon in a very sexually repressed atmosphere. And it took me a bit. Actually, it was the hot springs that did it. But it's a very liberating feeling, and you know, to shed those inhibitions and that false sense of shame for your body.
I agree with you. My experience is very similar. I don't know if it was related to religion or just being uncomfortable with my body. And I'm not saying I'm that much more comfortable now, but
you look
I don't care as much.
Honey.
I just don't care as
well,
much.
Well, you look
pretty
good.
Well, thank you.
I haven't seen you looking this comfortable in a long time, honey, with a recorder and a cigarette and a big smile on your nude body.
I was born naked.
That is great.
On the radio, I guess.
When I was a little kid, I lived in Pennsylvania, and my like neighbors would bring me home and ask my mom if this was hers.
Not a Jasmine.
There'd be a trail of clothes down the block.
Andrea was just kidding.
Really, this is yours. This is your natural state, and you know it.
But then later on, I was also raised in the Mormon faith, and so all those natural feelings got repressed.
And I'm back, baby.
Natural me.
It's the natural me. We have one more person if you want to put in your 2 cents.
Well, I think it's awesome that you guys are doing a radio show in the hot springs, a mile and a half in the middle of the woods.
It's
a good topic. And I think it's cool for whoever wants to wear their clothes or not wear their clothes.
And it doesn't make you uncomfortable as I sit here?
No, it's awesome. I think you never know what you're going to get when you come into the hot tub and how people are going to be, so at least bring a swimming suit.
Yes, it is.
And a recorder.
And a recorder.
And a recorder.
Well, thank you all for accommodating us.
And thanks so much to our post-Thanksgiving Day friends that we met in the hot springs. It was a great day. Now, on the same theme of nudity in the natural world, the last installment of today's show comes from a river trip that I took in 1998. One night, camped on a sandy beach of the Salmon River, spontaneous skinny dipping occurred. The 20-somethings in the group started it first, and then us 30-somethings joined in. Soon we had everyone taking the plunge up to the 60-year-olds. As it turned to night and the moon came up over the canyon walls, we moved out of the water and began dancing. And here's an entry in my journal that I wrote just a few days later. Ah, nudity. That freedom from civilization and self-consciousness. What a rare pleasure to revel in the naturalness of no clothes in a natural setting. What a rare pleasure to find that opportunity safely away from the civilization that cares too much about such things. What a rare pleasure to have nature offer the perfect temperature of air, covering of water, and then the surprising joy of full moonlight that allows complete revelry in such a simple thing as nudity. How rare to share these opportunities, these fortunate circumstances, and complete nudity with others of such diverse backgrounds. Had I been there alone, surely I would have bothered to dance naked in that brilliant moonlight, embraced by the sounds of the river and the warmth of the air and the solid walls of the canyon. I would have thought of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, which everyone should sing from time to time. But I sang that song with many others, some of whom shared a camaraderie of like minds, some of whom shared a camaraderie of alcohol. Many were close to disbelief the next day. I was not. I want to go back and dance in the full moonlight, unencumbered by clothes and fears and societal rules. I want to celebrate my wonderful, mobile, strong, imperfect body, rejoice in its assets and the part of it that's me, so integral to the whole of me. I want to praise the moving water, the changing beaches, the rocks and logs, the basalt and sedimentary canyon walls, and, of course, the moon, with the appreciation of a pagan and the awe of a child. As often as possible, and especially when life is just too serious and unnatural, I will dance naked in the moonlight, or starlight, or rain, celebrating me and the fields or trees, or a fire or the snow, depending on what nature offers. Sandy, the strong, the beautiful, the wise, the accidental creature who, somehow, came to be, to love, to hope, fortunately, but who doesn't know what to do with it that's of value or that makes a difference. Does it matter anyway? I will still be love and hope. I'm closing this Yin Radio program with music from The Wind Whistles. They're an indie folk duo out of Vancouver in Canada. They're Tom and Liza. This song is River. Yinradio@vpfound.org. That's Yin Radio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. You can catch past shows, get podcasts, and subscribe to our electronic newsletter for information about upcoming shows and Yin Radio news. All of this at yinradio.org. Yin Radio is now heard on community stations around the country. Special greetings to listeners at KPOV 106.7 FM in Bend, Oregon, and WRFA at 107.9 FM in Jamestown, New York. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho by VP Foundation and me. I'm Sandy Billings. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.